This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Cuevas, Behind Her Smile. And joining me from near Dallas, Texas, before I do that, Beverly, I would like to also read the subtitle. It's A Tall Girl from West Virginia and Her Life as a Stewardess. That's your subtitle of your book. Beverly, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Jay.
Honored to visit with you. You have a book. You had a lot to talk about. I won't ask how many years. Well, I will. How many years were you working as a stewardess?
I worked almost 35.
35 years, 381 pages. That is a lot of talking. Did you keep notes during that time, or was this something just came out of a creative urge to tell your story?
Well, actually, I kept diaries since I was about 13 years old, and I was pretty consistent up until probably mid-80s, but I had a lot of things written down in diaries, and I always wanted to write. When I was a young girl, I had dreams of being a country western singer, but when I was sitting out on the porch at my home in West Virginia, and I was singing at the top of my lungs, and my little granny ran out and thought I was hurt and said, "Janie, are you all right?" I figured my country western singing days were not going to happen.
Mm.
So I decided I would write a book.
Well, you've also mentioned that you were tall. I'm guessing that you still are. And when you mentioned mid-80s, I'm referring, I guess, to the time period, not your age.
Right. yes,
how tall
I am
is
very
tall.
I was actually almost 3 inches too tall to be a flight attendant at the time I interviewed in 1966. The height limit was 5'9", and I was almost close to 6 foot.
That's incredible.
So I kind of figured I had that stacked against me, but that wasn't what happened, and I'm forever grateful that I had a best friend who didn't like working as an insurance agent, and I didn't like working as a long-distance telephone operator. So she dared me to go on some interviews with her.
This is a book, sort of a memoir in its entirety, but what else is there besides telling behind the scenes secrets of the stewardess life? What would you say your book intent is all about?
Well, it was basically, I wanted the traveling public to have a different view of the young man or young woman flying and smiling, and everything is copacetic, and they're all trying to make their flight the best they can and get you to come back and fly on their airline, when at home their life was falling apart in a million different ways. And yet when you put that uniform on and you left and got to the airport and got on that airplane, you had to leave all of that at home. And I wanted people to realize that we weren't always just smiling, that sometimes our hearts were breaking, and that we had feelings and emotions too. And that's what I wanted basically the readers to learn about. And also the fact that just because you are almost 3 inches too tall and you think that your dreams can never happen, to not give up, because I went through 4 interviews before I actually got accepted with the airline I wanted to be with, which was American. I was also accepted by Eastern. But I wanted to take my mom and dad to Disneyland, and Eastern didn't fly there.
And did that ever take place? I mean, did you land with Eastern,
sure did.
Correct?
My very first pass, I took my mom and dad to Disneyland. When I was a little girl, I used to watch Walt Disney on TV, and when Jiminy Cricket would sing Wish Upon a Star, I would always wish that I could take my parents to Disneyland, because they were fascinated by it. And so I did. My very first pass, mom and dad and I went off to Disneyland.
In writing your book and going back through your, I'm having a mental block right
diaries,
now.
Diaries.
Thank you so much. your diaries over the years. Did you outline the book in the consistency of your diaries, or did you jump around and tell stories from all phases of your career?
Well, I guess I use the diary more or less as a reference, and in my mind, I went from actually growing up in Parkersburg, West Virginia, where my father was from, and all of his brothers and all of the family that we had there. And I just sort of started there with my family, which consisted of my dad, Raymond, and my mother, Helen, and my younger brother, Michael, and my younger sister, Charmaine. And I talked about what it was like for us. Unfortunately, Daddy came home from the war, and there weren't a whole lot of jobs to spread around. And he seemed to always find a job with a government contract. Hmm. And whenever that contract was up, Ray was the junior man, and he had to go find another job. I remember once in fourth grade looking out the window, watching my dad go from business to business to business, trying to find a job to support his family, and it broke my heart. But wow. he had a lot of pride, and we even had one Thanksgiving where we were actually fed by the Boy Scouts, and they have a very, very special place in my heart because they brought us a big turkey and a wooden laundry basket filled with all of the cranberries and the sweet potatoes and everything. And my dad was so surprised and so thankful, but yet he couldn't say anything. Daddy was extremely quiet. He walked away, and Mom stretched that turkey into about five or six different meals.
Wow.
we were pretty close to the poverty level because Daddy just, you know, like I said, couldn't seem to have a job that was more consistent than a couple of years with government contracts.
In spite of those very difficult times early in life, you managed to make it into a career that was highly desired and sought after. Would that be a way to describe that?
Absolutely, Jay. It was at the time we were the supermodels of the sky. In the 60s, it was just like a beyond belief career to be able to be a stewardess. I was told when I got to stewardess school that one out of every 5,000 applicants was even considered. And then once they were accepted, that not all of the ones that were even starting stewardess school ever graduated because it was like boot camp. I kid you not.
Very tough.
We had our hair could only touch the top of our collar. We had to basically spit shine our shoes. We had a uniform with white gloves, and they had to be absolutely dust and lint free. When we walked through the airport, we had to wear heels, and when we were on the airplane, we were allowed to wear alternates, which were a flatter type shoe to be able to work. But we always worked in skirts. We didn't have pants or anything like that like they had later on. And I think a friend of mine read an article to me from People magazine, and a gentleman who played Robert Leonard from House, they were interviewing him and asking him what he thought about the new actresses in Hollywood now, and he said, give me a stewardess from the late 60s, early 70s, wow, because that was the epitome of class.
Incredible.
And that's how I felt.
Incredible. Your flight experiences and countries that you visited, which of those is the most exciting look-back memory that you have?
Well, I loved London, but I was beyond excited to be able to go to New Zealand. I just couldn't imagine going somewhere so far away. Unfortunately, that's not the part that's in the first part of my book. My book only has the first 10 years of my flying career, and I didn't go on to international until 1980, which is 3 years after the book ended.
Were you holding back for a sequel, perhaps?
Well, you know what? I've been encouraged to do that, but this was quite an expensive endeavor, and I had no idea how it would snowball, starting out with, you know, the initial payment of hiring the publisher, and then other things came up. And I do have a sequel in the back of my mind, but it won't be quite the same as the first one. The first one had a purpose of not only sharing what it's like behind the scenes with a flight attendant or stewardess, but the second one is more in about my relationship with the Lord and how he guided my family through 7 years of Job's sandals. Wow. But the first one was more about the challenges of being the tallest girl in class, the most flat-chested, talking with an accent, and having, unfortunately, a restaurant in Columbus, Ohio named the Big Bev. And I was forever being teased about that. So somewhat in underlying, there's some bullying going on there that I had to overcome. And I think there was quite a bit of difference from the way I was raised in West Virginia versus the way some folks were raised in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
In West Virginia, we didn't go to any place that we saw people who were Negroes or black people. And when I went to school in Ohio the first time, my mom, bless her heart, she and my dad, neither one graduated from high school. But mom told me, my brother and I were very young. I was going into the fifth grade, and Mike was going into the third grade. And my mom said we had to go to school with colored kids. Well, we started laughing because we imagined they would be green and red and yellow.
Right.
But, of course, we found out that that wasn't the case. And one of my best friends from fourth or fifth grade turned out to be a young black girl, and we stayed friends until she moved. But it was a completely different experience in West Virginia. My father's family was very well known, and my grandmother was a cook for a lot of prominent doctors and stuff like that. But my dad was one of five boys, and he was raised in a children's home. And so it was quite a change for him to move to West Virginia to Ohio. He didn't even have a driver's license, Jay, until he was 32 years old.
Incredible. Incredible. I have some of the, not those same stories in my history, but my dad was not formally educated and still was successful in his life, and so was my mom. They had character, which, you know, and integrity. Those are things that sometimes are missing in our current society, unfortunately. But
absolutely.
In reading your book, what do you think, what story or what reflection do you think is going to be the one outstanding reflection that you have recounted?
I believe it would probably be the fact that I fell in love with a professional basketball player. I was unfortunately married and in an unhappy marriage at the time when I met him. And he played for the New York Nets. His name was Wendell Ladner. And he was just someone who completely, I fell head over heels in love with when I first met him. My marriage was not what I anticipated. My mom and dad both said they didn't want me to marry this gentleman, but I was in love. I was 21 years old, and I just thought that that's where I was supposed to be. Unfortunately, 9 years later, I finally decided that wasn't right for me, but I do regret the fact that I had an affair, but I don't regret the fact that the wonderful man that I met during that particular situation, and I talk about him and how he was raised in Keel, Mississippi, but he was actually from Pas Christian, Mississippi. And so he was a fascinating person. He had a reputation. He played for the Kentucky Colonels when I met him, which was part of the ABA, and he was considered the fan favorite. And he was quite a character, quite a character.
Mm-hmm. Any other people or famous characters that you met during your career? Yes,
I met quite a few, but my favorite was Elvis Presley. When I was a young girl, 16, I went to see. I never liked Elvis. I thought he was greasy, and I thought, oh my gosh, just to touch that greasy hair would be one of the worst things in the world. But when he shaved his hair and he went into the army, I thought, oh my goodness, those beautiful eyes. And my friend Karen, who also took me to the Stewardess interviews, we went to see G.I. Blues. And he was in the ski lift with Juliet Prowse, and he leaned over and kissed her. And I said to my friend Karen, who looked more like Annette Funicello, and I said, Karen, one day I'm going to meet Elvis Presley, and he's going to kiss me just like that. Well, she nearly dropped all popcorn on the floor. And sure enough, 1968 in February, Elvis Aaron Presley walked on my flight, and we had an immediate attraction to each other and had an evening of getting to know him and listening to him talk. He was pretty young at that time and had only been popular for, you know, a while, but he was very shy and very kind and very, very approachable, and I really enjoyed talking with him. Of course, the girls I was flying with, one of them thought, oh my God, he didn't do a thing for her. And the other one kept telling me, I hate you, Bev, I hate you, I hate you, because he was in my cabin. And we met, and he ended up writing me a little note, which I kept and held on to for years. And I went to see Elvis in Lake Tahoe, and I saw him in Tulsa. But once I got divorced, I decided I wanted to contact him. So I, through J.D. Sumner and actually his father, I was given Elvis's private phone number by an American Airlines employee who gave it to me from Memphis. And I called, and I talked to Mr. Presley Vernon, and I said he was on my flight, and we had a very enjoyable evening together. And I said, I would like very much to see him. Well, he jokingly said, "Are you going to make my son an offer he can't refuse?" And I said, "I sincerely hope so, sir." But it turns out that I ended up giving a picture of from my modeling career to Joe Esposito. And Joe remembered me from Tahoe because I was like so many inches taller than Joe. And when I first met him, I had on this hot pink dress and I had a tan, and I just had my hair all beautiful blonde. And so Joe said, "Yeah, I remember you, Bev, but I'm not sure if Elvis will, because he meets so many people." Mm-hmm. So he asked me to send him a picture of Elvis, and I did, or I'm send Elvis a picture of me, and I did. And Elvis showed up at my hotel room in Memphis.
Incredible.
It was awesome. He was just quite a complex character. He was so different, though, the second time that I was with him. And I actually have these things, Jay, that I call gut feelings, and I had a very bad feeling that night that Elvis was not going to be with us very much longer. And sure enough, 2 years after I met him and stayed in touch with him, he was gone.
Wow.
And I'd had previous experiences, like the day I told my roommate I was going to meet the man I was going to marry, and he was going to be real tall and have blonde hair and blue eyes. And she laughed. She said, "You wouldn't even look at a man with blonde hair and blue eyes, because you always like men with dark hair and brown eyes." And sure enough, I met the man I ended up marrying that, I guess it was almost 2 years after meeting him. But I've always had these feelings that things are going to happen. And when I met Wendell, I got on the airplane, and this was not really my fault, my feeling. The other girl said to me, "Do you think you'll ever see a man who's as good-looking as Tom Selleck?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "No." And that's when Tom Selleck was the Marlboro Man, and
right. It
was right before Magnum P.I. And so she said, "Well, why don't you turn around and look at the guy in 25F? And I turned around, and I looked at Wendell, and I almost died because he was so handsome. And I did have a feeling, because my ex and I were not, well, he wasn't my ex at the time, getting along very well. And I had a feeling I was going to meet someone who was going to turn my world upside down. And he did.
Well, that's fascinating story all the way through. And this book
is loaded
with those personal comments. I'm sorry, personal insights and personal reflections. This is a book that should be entertaining, plus, do you think, inspirational to the people who read it?
I would hope so. The fact that I, you know, loved my family and how important they were to me, and that's the way I was raised, and how I live with a lot of guilt for breaking one of the Ten Commandments. And I also wanted to encourage people, as I said, that even though you may have a dream that you think is not attainable, that you should not give up. You should go for it, you know, and just hang in there.
Good advice. Excellent.
Thank you.
The title of the book, again, is Cuevas, Behind Her Smile, Stories of a Tall Girl from West Virginia and Her Life as a Stewardess. And Cuevas is spelled C-U-E-V-A-S, if you're looking for it at your local bookstore. Where else can they get a copy of this?
They can get it through Lulu.
Lulu Press?
Yes. Lulu Publishing. If they go to lulu.com, Spotlight, Behind Her Smile, they can get the book from Lulu. And it comes in paperback, hardback, and also in ebooks.
They might also look on Amazon and maybe Barnes & Noble. Some of the other online booksellers might be able to locate it for them as well. Their local bookseller can find it if they look under the title, Cuevas, Behind Her Smile. Beverly, thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. This is a fascinating book, 300 and some pages. You had a lot to say, but I think maybe the sequel might have some other insights that you want to share. Thank you for joining me today.
May I just share one thing
Absolutely.
With you? The young lady who edited my book said to me after reading it, she said, "You brought me to tears, you made me laugh, and you inspired me all in a space of 10 pages. And I hope that that's how my readers will feel after they've had a chance to read all the things I shared.
Thank you, Beverly, for joining me and sharing your
heart. Welcome.
I appreciate your insight. Thank you again. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors, all quilters just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
The title of the book, G&T Defense. George W. Bush and Tony Blair, Heroes, Not Villains. And the author is Mark B. Jardine. And Mark joins us from Perth, Australia. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Steve.
Well, great to have you on the show, Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to everyone by Lulu Publishing. The G&T Defense. You see things quite differently than often George W. Bush and Tony Blair are painted, especially when it comes to the tragedy of war. And, of course, the Afghanistan war that took a lot of lives, but you're claiming that they really saved lives.
Yes, that's right. Or at least saved more lives than were lost.
That whole scenario of Afghanistan and Iraq, I think it's gotten everyone confused and really don't understand what's behind it all. And that's what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to help everyone understand the whole context of it.
That's correct, yeah. Because Bush and Blair, of course, widely condemned because the Iraq war did go wrong and, you know, all war is tragic and people lost their lives. But I do feel that people often forget, surprisingly, why the Afghanistan war happened. You know, it was a direct response to 9/11 and the planning for 9/11 undoubtedly came from Pakistan. From Afghanistan, and the Taliban in Afghanistan refused to give up Al-Qaeda. But interestingly enough, my research tells me that just the health improvements alone from the Afghanistan war save hundreds of thousands of lives a year. And the initial attacks of the war, in relative terms, did not cost a great deal of lives, tragic as they were.
Well, you claim, and I'm using your words here, hysterical and widespread accusation of lies and dishonesty against Bush and Blair. Why were those generated, do you think?
I think that people, very many people, have the gift of hindsight. And, you know, it's easy after the war, particularly the Iraq war, if we're talking about that, and that's where what I see as hysterical accusations come from, that's very easy to see that the issue of weapons of mass destruction was a mistake, of course. But before the war, every single intelligence agency in the world believed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and that included the Syrian intelligence agency. So the accusations of lies would mean that Bush and Blair knew for sure that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, but decided in some sort of evil, Dr. Evil manner to attack Iraq anyway. And I think the second point to add to that is that the Iraq war was not entirely about weapons of mass destruction. It was about sticking to the terms of Resolution 687 from the 1991 war. So the focus, the unnatural focus, I think, on weapons of mass destruction is unwarranted. There were many, many other reasons for the war which were verified by, you know, both houses of Congress when it happened.
Why all the interest, Mark? Why did you do this?
I think I see such widespread condemnation of these leaders. I see a lot of calls for court cases, you know, calling for the execution of these leaders because they're war criminals. And my feeling is that there are plenty of other war criminals in the world that were at the time. Mullah Omar, Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, to me, are very clearly war criminals. And that Bush and Blair were trying to remove a known war criminal, a proven genocidal dictator. And, you know, they did that very effectively. It only took 4 weeks, again with relatively few casualties, and then the reaction by extremist Islamist forces, mostly inspired by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was the progenitor of ISIS, that led to the prolongation of the war, massive suicide attacks, and in fact that's where most of the casualties come from, not from the West.
A lot of people would say we were there because of all that oil. We wanted to protect our interest and even, you know, get more oil.
Yeah. I think that's a total myth. The proof in this case is in the pudding. The United States never took a drop of oil. You know, and my argument is Western countries don't march into other places and load up their tankers with oil. That's not how it works. Oil is obviously very, very important, and was very important to Saddam Hussein, and was very important in the region. But, you know, Iraq controls its own oil. It's after the Iraq war, it gave concessions to oil companies. Not one of those companies was an American or a U.S. oil company. It went to other countries. So it doesn't make sense to me. The United States has never invaded another country for oil. It never did it in 1991. Why would it suddenly be the case now? It made the region important. It made getting rid of Saddam Hussein more important, mainly for his neighbors, for Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. But to say that the United States went into Iraq for oil is, in my opinion, totally false. And there are a number of Arab left-wing writers, or certainly one quite important one, who agrees with me. He doesn't think that it was for, you know, for oil. It's a very simplistic sort of cry, in my opinion.
Now, your background is history. You teach it.
Correct.
And so this, is it something that you hear a lot from young people? They repeat a lot of what you're calling these lies, and that, you know, kind of generated all this interest by you?
Yes, to a certain extent. You know, the idea that the West or American forces just go in and bomb indiscriminately and killed hundreds of thousands of people, when I look more closely, it's not the case. You know, civilian casualties in the 2003 war were something like the maximum of 4,300 in the original attack, which is absolutely dreadful. But you know, Saddam Hussein could have stopped that at any time. And the calculations of casualties in the following war were between 100,000 and 1.33 million. How did 900,000 lives get confused in that way? But to get back to your main question, yeah, a lot of young people trot out these what I see as platitudes and generalizations, and then I see them on millions of comments on news sites. And you know, when I look closely, they are not verified. I think the real villains were the Islamic extremists who prolonged the Iraq war, the Taliban, and of course Saddam Hussein, who really started the whole process through his expansionist brutal wars against Iran and Kuwait.
Americans just don't understand this fanaticism, do they? This fundamental extremism that drives these people even to give up their own lives, even young people, to blow themselves up. I mean, it's beyond, I think, American understanding of this kind of, as we just said, fanaticism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sure if it's that they don't understand it. It's people have, I suppose, acknowledged that it exists. But my worry is that they blame themselves for it. A lot of Americans and left-wing commentators in the world blame the United States for its existence and for its proliferation. And I think that's very dangerous. I think it was Christopher Hitchens who said terrorists aren't don't follow, or their actions are not responsible for any other policies than themselves. In other words, you know, stop blaming the West for fanaticism. The proof or the evidence in the book I've written is that the West intervened in Kosovo in 1999 and in Sierra Leone in 2000, and it was extremely successful. They stopped manic violence, pretty much genocide, by the Serbs at the time. And so if intervention can work very successfully in some areas and doesn't in others, what's the common denominator? And it's this extremism, fanaticism. When it's not there, it's quite successful. Therefore, don't keep blaming the West for these problems. Blame the fanaticism. Seems pretty obvious.
Blaming us for our lifestyle, our freedom, our standard of living, what is it that we're being blamed for?
Well, yes, and then it comes right back to the fanaticism of the religion itself, that a lifestyle like that is seen to be sinful and wrong, and, you know, that's just an ideological difference. But that has led to attacks, you know, and then using the United States and NATO and the West's attempts to get rid of dictators as an excuse. But yes, I mean, what you say is right. There seems to be a deep-seated hatred, resentment, need to attack that sort of thing. And as Osama bin Laden was very clear about that, that the West should be attacked, and that he sent out a fatwa in 1998 to say that it's the duty of every Muslim to kill infidels, including women and children. And having said that, you know, there's more outcry against Bush and Blair than a statement like that. Doesn't make any sense to me.
Now, Barack Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize. You're saying there's two others more deserving.
Yes. I feel some sympathy for Barack Obama. He's, you know, such a brilliant speechmaker and such an engaging personality, and did create this sort of sense of hope at the beginning of his term of office. But I do feel it's a grave mistake by the Nobel Committee to award a Nobel Peace Prize on the basis of, you know, well-meaning speeches. Then as you go through the Barack Obama presidency, his foreign policy I don't think was very successful. He decided to withdraw troops from Iraq, which seemed on the face of it to be a reasonable thing to do, you know, this unjust war, let's pull out. But the result was a terrible tragedy, the rise of ISIS, the very, very worst extremists that have been seen in recent history. You know, these guys enslaved young girls, threw gay people off roofs. They're still doing it. And, you know, the outcome was not more peace. It was more atrocities. Afghanistan, I argue in the book, he did quite well on, because he saw it as a just war, and I certainly see it as a just war. I think it would be horrific for the Taliban to come flooding back in. But when you weigh up Obama's achievements, they hardly created more peace in the world. I'd challenge someone to tell me where this happened. The Iran deal was a well-meaning attempt, but doesn't seem to have created many guarantees. And my personal belief is that Obama's greatest failure was in Nigeria, where 300 girls were kidnapped by a fanaticist group called Boko Haram, and nobody did anything. I know it's Nigeria's job to sort it out, but, you know, as the leader of the free world, surely the United States and its allies could have organized the rescue of 300 young girls from archaic barbarian extremists who simply use them as sex slaves and apparently have trained them to be suicide bombers, have brainwashed them in some cases.
As a father and a grandfather, that's just overwhelming. I mean, that's there's no way to relate to that, that kind of barbarism.
Absolutely. It's unsupportable in any society, any culture. And in no way can the West be blamed for that sort of thing. And yet, I think either subliminally or openly, many left-wing commentators, you know, blame the West for everything. Every time there's an atrocity, they say, oh, well, you know, we caused the problems in the Middle East, and you know, we are Islamophobic or something like that. And you know, I think it's time we stop doing that. And people who commit those acts must take responsibility for it themselves, talking as someone in the West, as it were.
Before we find out the best way to get your book, just talk a little bit about your research. You said it was most challenging, but at the same time, most rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, at the time of the Iraq War, there was a lot of concern about the whole weapons issue, and I thought too little concern about what Saddam Hussein was not doing. He was not cooperating with the United Nations commissions on weapons inspections, that sort of thing. So I was very interested in it, and I was very interested in the reaction to the war. I was teaching in an Australian school at the time. And I think it's the first time I've seen the sort of anti-Americanism develop in a Western country to that extent, and that really concerned me because I worry that we're entering an age of moral relativity where you forget about absolute principles and you make excuses for other cultures or other movements, you know, and that leads to people blaming themselves. And quite a few people in the West are beginning to do that. And you know, some people think you can solve that by mass immigration, allowing illegal immigration to solve the problems of third world countries or the Middle East. It's something that I really got to think about in 2003. But then I was too busy teaching, which was lovely, for the next 13 years. And then I'm semi-retired now. So I thought, well, look, let me have a careful look and see if there's any evidence to support my suspicions, my hypotheses that in fact this whole anti-Americanism, blame ourselves for the Iraq war, war criminals, lies, does have any foundation. And the more I looked, the more evidence I found that, you know, it's too simplistic to look at it like that. There's the Bush and Blair have in fact, if you look at George Bush, George W. Bush's record, just in the health field, in the area of PEPFAR, his program that he insisted on AIDS treatment in Africa, within 4 years of him insisting on that, 1 million lives were saved in Africa. I mean, nobody ever talks about that. You know, you just hear these cries of war criminals and lies. He also insisted on malaria prevention. You know, that's another few million. It's something like 7.7 million people saved from AIDS deaths from that program called PEPFAR between 2003 and 2015, and George W. Bush insisted on that. Now, if you balance saving of 9 million lives against a possible 100,000 lives in Iraq, it's a pretty positive balance, even given the tragedy of the war.
We've been talking with Mark B. Jardine. He's the author of his book, The G&T Defense, George W. Bush and Tony Blair, Heroes, Not Villains. Mark, tell us the best way to get your book.
The best way would be go straight to Lulu, but it is available on Amazon as well, and I think on Barnes & Noble. I do have a website, Mark B. Jardine Author, Mark Jardine Author, which has got the links if you're at all interested.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, Exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat. And as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
The title of the book, Uncertainty Advantage, Leadership Lesson for Turning Risk Outside In. And the author is Gary S. Lynch. And Gary joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Gary.
Good morning. How are you, Steve?
Great to have you with us. This is a risky talk. We're going to talk about risk, business risk. As you put it, uncertainty equals opportunity. I don't know if everyone would agree with you on that. I think most people are afraid of uncertainty, aren't they?
Yeah, I think our tendency as human beings, our behavioral tendency, is to think about uncertainty as risk, and therefore risk is potentially bad, and let's do everything we can to prevent bad things from happening.
So you're going to talk about a market-driven strategy for navigating risk, and also you've got some principles that leaders have in common. Your whole goal is to, I guess, transform organization and make sure they're keeping up with the times and they're going to be successful.
The goal of the book, you know, if I look at this very simply, it's, you know, we can look at things as a glass half empty or half full. And this is one of those cases where not only are we looking at it as half full, but we're looking at the opportunities of it being half full. So when we look at uncertainty, which is the unknown could bring very positive results and very negative results. Risk, on the other hand, tends to be something that is an extension of uncertainty. You know, you transform uncertainty into risk, and what you try to do with risk is measure it and measure the best of the worst situations so that you can make decisions and hopefully get some positive return. But they are different. Uncertainty and risk are different, and I'm going to talk about the uncertainty piece and the piece that's really controlled by the leaders in the organization. As they look to grow their markets and they look at competitive strategies and strategic decisions, I mean, it's nice to think about risk, and they have to think about risk. But quite frankly, if they don't think about profitability and cost and pricing, well, then there is no risk to manage because their business isn't making any money and it's not providing any value to the customer. We're trying to change the thinking and really augment existing thinking with this concept of uncertainty and uncertainty advantage, and looking at it from the point of view of competitive strategy and taking the unknown, knowing more about it, and then turning it into profits or turning it into opportunity.
So it's not an event-driven topic.
It's event-driven in the context of it can be event-driven. Okay, so the events like hurricanes, fires, floods, and those kinds of events, but really it's a change-driven topic. So when change occurs, if there was no change, there'd be no uncertainty, right? We'd all kind of figure things out eventually if everything stayed the same. But the fact that environments and markets and competitors and customers and rivals and all the dynamics of a market continually change, it becomes more of a change-based topic. So when change occurs, the question is, okay, what is the unknown? When I have that kind of situation of trying to figure out the unknown, do I use the same techniques for managing my business and making business decisions? Do I apply that same thinking to uncertainty and the unknown? Do I dig as deep? Do I go as fast? Do I understand the unknown in the context of my customers and the producers and the suppliers? or am I looking unknown only from an internal perspective? I'm using a new computer system, and therefore I'm using the cloud, and I don't know about the cloud and risk in the cloud. They're really two different things.
Let's talk about some examples to help us better understand of your philosophy and what has been working for you. Let's talk about Tesla.
This was a recent example, and it applies to the driverless car, and it applies to a specific situation in China where Tesla felt that and had the data to prove that the driverless car was actually a safer car than other cars. And so therefore, they thought, knowing more about uncertainty, they should be able to leverage that uncertainty on behalf of their customers, and a result would be more aggressive, better pricing for auto insurance. They didn't have much success with the underwriters in convincing them to lower premiums or expand coverage. So what Tesla decided to do is quietly offer the auto insurance as part of the car, of selling the Tesla vehicle, and to provide that insurance at a very deep discount as part of a understanding of uncertainty about something in the market that they understood better than their competition and therefore can turn into competitive advantage and competitive strategy.
Because on the surface, you would think a driverless car is filled with risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But again, you know, especially now that the car has been deployed for some time, there's enough data, and there continues to be more and more data. You know, Tesla was looking to take advantage of that opportunity and say, we believe in this data, and we're going to reward the customer in this case by lowering costs. And anytime you lower costs, you increase profitability, you know, potential profitability. So,
transforming,
you know, assuming you can get the pricing and the cost balanced, of course.
Right. And so transforming risk into a market advantage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And their understanding of risk. So first it was the mindset of having this mindset of saying, okay, we're putting a driverless car in the market. Oh, gosh, we've got to address all these concerns about, you know, potential accidents, potential liabilities. And I'm not suggesting those are not important, but they become part of the operational process. And so that's the, okay, so what do we do if things do go wrong type of mentality. But the other mentality is, okay, we know something that others don't know, and we know it about uncertainty, so therefore, is it something we can leverage? Very similar to some of the other examples we'll probably discuss in a little while, but in this case, they were able to leverage it, and they had the mindset, their leaders had the mindset to say, let's be aggressive and let's use this for benefit.
Well, tell us the Hyundai story.
Well, the Hyundai story is an interesting one. There's actually several Hyundai stories. John Kraftlich, the CEO of Hyundai North America at the time, had led his organization through a few of these examples. But the one that I like the most is the one related to the earthquakes in Japan, the devastating earthquake that occurred in 2011 in Japan, and, of course, the subsequent tsunami and other disruptions. And what was interesting is that one of the sole source suppliers of paint pigments in the market, in the auto market, supplied this pigment that made the paint kind of have a luster or a shiny color to it. That particular sole source supplier and sole site in northern Japan was wiped out. It was a Merck plant. And Merck sold to the entire industry, all the big original equipment manufacturers, JM, Chrysler. And so when you lose and you have a single point of failure like that and you lose that capability, the reaction is, okay, I've got to go and get capacity. And I have to figure out where I'm going to get that capacity from since it's going to be, the market is going to be short on that capacity. And usually the big players will be able to grab the capacity more quickly and grab whatever's there. And what that translates into is for the dealers and for the buyers, the customers, the potential shortage of, in this case, black and red color cars. And which means that you're communicating to your customer that you potentially are not getting what you would like. Hyundai, knowing that, of course, they weren't one of the biggest players at the time, understood this risk. So they had a better understanding of the risk profile of this single source or this sole source. And what they did is they prepared and reacted differently and said, you know, if this supplier does go away, we're not going to depend on the traditional methods of managing risk and gaining capacity and diversifying and doing all these other standard risk techniques. We're going to look at this a little differently. And we're going to identify this as a area that we need to develop something different. What they did is they utilized a different type of pigment. It was a mica material that they used to allow them to create black and the same effect on the black and red cars, and to have cars back in the markets within 2 to 3 months back on the lots, whereas their competitors in some examples wouldn't have the cars on the lots for 6 to 12 months. They kept sight, you know, it goes back to the mindset, the leader saying, A, you know, if something goes wrong, yes, I have to deal with the negative, but I also could see that as an opportunity if I understand my competitors, you know, my rivals and how they might deal with this. And I need to make some investment in competencies and capabilities to figure out alternatives that we could bring to the market, because we never want to lose sight of the customer. And we want to give the customer, in this case, the dealers and the customers, what they want, which were red and black cars. And it was a brilliant move. And I believe they sold out of their inventory as a result of that, of the red and black cars. Now, it created some other challenges as far as managing two lines on the supply chain, because now, you know, when the other color came back online, they had to manage different SKUs. But the point was that they had a better understanding of the risk profile, and they could position themselves as such, knowing ahead of time that sole source suppliers, that should be a flag. There is an opportunity potentially there, not just a risk.
We have a couple minutes left before we find out the best way to get your book. Tell us about your own personal story.
My personal story is one of evolving through the world of risk through the industry side. I used to manage operational risk and cyber risk. I was the chief risk officer, security officer for Chase Manhattan Bank and Prudential and a few other companies. And I moved through to the consulting side for companies like Booz Allen. And I always helped organizations in their strategies for managing risk. And I did this traveling around the globe. I spent 10 years at Marsh & McLennan working with very large clients, more than a dozen countries, figuring out how to look at risk and supply chain risk. But there seemed to be something missing. The CEOs of those companies, as we moved through solving these problems, had a different priority. You know, they were certainly focused more on competitive strategy. They were focused on strategic decisions and profitability, and not necessarily operational effectiveness of managing risk in the organization. And I thought that they weren't being served. That was a customer that wasn't being served and needed to be served. So I started to build out some solutions with several teams. I worked with a number of universities. I am a senior research fellow over at the University of Maryland. I work with MIT, McGill, and others. And we started to construct some solutions and try them out in the market, apply them in the market. So I was managing my own risk at the time, and I decided strongly that I really needed to come to closure on a framework for all of this in this book. So I pulled the plug on my career, as I'd done before. I blew up my career at the time. I stopped, put the brakes on, and said I'm going to dig in my heels for the next year to 2 years, bring the research together, work with these leaders, put this into the form of a book, and now go out there and continue to move through the research to see how we can help organizations really focus on competitive strategies.
And the book title, everyone, Uncertainty Advantage, Leadership Lesson for Turning Risk Outside In. We've been listening to Gary S. Lynch. He is the author. Gary, what's the best way to get your book?
Best way to get it is either through the Archway site, or you can go to uncertaintyadvantage.com, order it through the homepage there, or you can, of course, go to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other major sellers like that.
Gary, thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much, Steve.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Archway Publishing.
Yeah. You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing. Join us again next week at noon Eastern.